Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is. Welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Bob Doty in Washington. Today on the program, some nations are attempting to cut links between the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Eastern Congo's mineral exports. Later in the show, we hear what Western governments are doing to avoid fueling the unrest. But first, researchers recently produced a map of mining areas in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The map shows mines under the control of the Congolese army and armed groups. The study suggests that the top conflict mineral in the area is now gold. Economics reporter Mario Ritter has more on the story.
A Belgian group, the International Peace Information Service, carried out the study in partnership with the DRC Registry of Mines. The researchers found that armed groups were involved in about 200 of the 800 mines they studied. The Congolese army was involved at 265 mines. The researchers reported that both the military and the militias are taxing mine workers illegally. The International Peace Information Service carried out a similar survey in 2009. Philip Hilgert was the lead researcher. He told VOA the map they made 4 years ago is no longer correct. He said many of the miners are now digging for gold. And he said the armed groups are profiting much more from gold than from other conflict minerals such as tin, tungsten, and tantalum. These minerals are often called the three T's. One reason for the change has been an increase in the price of gold. Another reason has been stronger international rules for mineral imports. The United States Congress passed legislation to fight the trade of conflict minerals. Mr. Hilgert says such efforts have had a big effect on trade in the three T's, but it has not affected the gold trade. Judith Sargentini is a member of the European Parliament. She has been campaigning for a European law on conflict minerals. She notes that gold, like diamonds, is easy to transport in small amounts. That explains why it is hard to know where it was mined. The German Geological Institute, BGR, has collected minerals from hundreds of mines in Rwanda. The collection could be used to prove whether a sample of minerals came from a conflict area. But Judith Sargentini suggests that geophysical tests will not work. She says buyers need to know about their suppliers.
You cannot solve every trade in commodity by trying to find out what the geological background of a material is. It shows that you need, first of all, a due diligence supply chain, and second of all, initiatives that lead to fair trade gold mining.
Due diligence, in this case, means knowing and being able to trust your supplier.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Bob Doty. Western governments want to cut links between the conflict in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo and the area's mineral exports. Both the United States and the European Union have taken steps to tighten control of mineral imports to avoid fueling the conflict in eastern Congo. Mario Ritter has more.
The United States Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010. The law deals mainly with financial rules, but it also includes a special requirement for American-listed companies. It says buyers of tin, tantalum, tungsten, or gold need to show they have not supported conflict in Africa's Great Lakes area. Now, the European Union is also writing a bill to prevent deals that help private armies in the eastern Congo. Judith Sargentini says the aim of the European law is to help break the link between the minerals trade and armed conflict. She suggests the law will require EU companies buying minerals to prove they were mined without supporting the conflict in the Congo.
We cannot just have the U.S. work on the issue where we are the bigger trading countries with Africa and ignore this. It will influence European companies that want to trade on the U.S. market. But besides that, more importantly, Europe has a responsibility towards a lot of countries that are actually even former colonies.
She says the bill is not a reaction to an increase in Chinese imports of these minerals by companies that are not concerned about the Dodd-Frank Act.
But I would say that European communication on trade in raw materials, of course, is completely influenced by the fear that Europe has that China will buy out everything and we don't have anything in the future anymore.
Judith Sargentini says the American law reduced trade and jobs. She notes that the proposed law will not stop imports from eastern Congo. She says some imports will continue even if the minerals were mined under what she called bad circumstances. Critics say the Dodd-Frank Act stopped trade and led to the illegal transport of minerals through nearby countries. Ms. Sargentini agrees, but says the planned law should have a different effect. She says the EU Trade Commissioner wants to increase trade with the Congo. She says the law will reward businesses that make an effort to trade minerals fairly and openly. Some Congolese experts say they think the Dodd-Frank Act has helped to cut the flow of money to militia leaders. In eastern Congo, workers at the Enough Project say people have changed behaviors because of it, but the conflict minerals part of the law has yet to be enforced. I'm Mario Ritter.
And that is As It Is. I'm Bob Doty. Be listening again tomorrow for another program from VOA Learning English. Keep listening to VOA for the latest world news, coming up at the top of the hour, Universal Time. Thanks for spending part of your day with us.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has appealed for international action to stop religious violence in the Central African Republic. Mr. Ban asked the Security Council on Thursday to deploy at least 3,000 more troops to the country within the coming days and weeks. He said, "When innocent civilians are being murdered in large numbers, deliberately targeted in the most brutal fashion simply because of who they are, the world must act." More than 7,000 African Union and French forces are already in the country. The European Union has promised to send another 1,000 soldiers. The Central African Republic is a former French colony. This week, Mr. Ban also proposed $38 million in financial and other aid for the AU forces. He worries the religious violence could turn into genocide. The unrest began a year ago after Muslim rebels ousted the president, François Bozizé. His overthrow and resulting violence led to a majority Christian militia. Its members are accused of carrying out attacks against Muslim civilians. Since December, hundreds of people have died in clashes between Muslims and Christians. Tens of thousands have fled the country in the past month. The militiamen call themselves the anti-Balaka. Balaka is said to be a word for knife or machete in a local language. Militia members say they came to the capital, Bangui, in December to oust the government of Michel Djotodja, the country's first Muslim president. But international forces have accused the anti-Balaka of being the problem. They say its fighters are increasingly turning to attacking homes and businesses. Some fighters are only teenagers. They have set up roadblocks on country roads, carrying weapons and demanding money. French and African troops have used force to disarm them. The anti-Balaka has been described as a loose alliance, and several leaders claim to speak for the men. Joaquim Kokate represented the militia at a meeting in January. He says it is time for justice. He says those organizing theft and extrajudicial killings should be targeted and they should answer for their acts. Many anti-Balaka fighters tell VOA they want the same treatment the Muslim Seleka rebels are receiving. That means they want food, shelter, and financial aid. They also want the chance to join the National Army as part of a disarmament agreement. Some fighters consider themselves liberators of their country. Others see the conflict as becoming a battle between religious groups. But the militias are made up of both Christians and animists, people who believe that natural objects have spirits. They say they are motivated by nationalism, not religion. Anti-Balaka leaders say they have tens of thousands of fighters. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember.
Now the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called Mr. Black. It was written by American reporter Charles Kuralt. It is from his book, A Life on the Road. For many years, Charles Kuralt traveled across the United States, telling interesting stories about Americans. His stories were broadcast on the CBS television network. Later, some were published in books. Here is Shep O'Neill with Mr. Kuralt's story called Mr. Black.
George Black was a brickmaker. He mixed dirt and water, poured the mixture into forms, and heated the forms until the mixture was hard. During his life, many structures were built with his handmade bricks. George Black became a pretty good diplomat for the American State Department, too. But that part of his story comes later. George Black's father died in 1889. George was 11 years old. His brother was 14. We will not be able to go to school, his brother said. We are going to have to work for a living. If we work hard and make men out of ourselves, even if we do not know the difference between A and B, people will call us Mr. Black someday. George repeated his brother's words proudly more than 80 years later. By then, he was a very old man. Everybody called him Mr. Black. The two little boys, George and his brother, set out on their own in 1889. They walked the 40 miles from their village in North Carolina to the nearest big city, Winston-Salem. They worked for a brickmaker for a while. After they learned how to make bricks, they started their own business. By the time I met George Black, he had been making bricks for a very long time. He still used the same method. He tied a mule to what he called a mud mill. The mule walked slowly in a circle, turning the mill. The mill mixed dirt and water, creating the wet mud from which bricks are made. Mr. Black gathered up the mud in his big hands and put just the right amount in each form. It was then ready to be heated in a hot fire. Each form made 6 bricks. How many bricks do you think you have made in your life? I asked him. Oh, he said, I do not know. I would be afraid to know. I made 1,000,000 bricks 1 year. Mr. R.J. Reynolds wanted to build a tobacco factory. He asked me if I thought I could make 1,000,000 bricks. I studied and said, yes, I could. I did, too. You can go see them if you want to. That building is still there. They are all my bricks. Yes, sir. I found myself filled with great respect for this man. He was standing in a hole in the ground, covered in mud. He had made a life of earth and water and fire. He had made the building blocks of a city. The next day, Mr. Black put on his best clothes, and we walked around Winston-Salem. "These bricks we are walking on," he said, "I made these only about 40 years ago." He pointed with his walking stick. "I made the bricks for that church over there. I made the bricks for that wall." Wherever we walked, he pointed out the work of his own hands. When we reached the huge tobacco factory, he spoke again. "I believe I told you wrong about this job. It was not 1 million bricks. It was 1.5 million. Made them 6 at a time, for $1.50 a day. That was good pay in those days. Yes, sir. Made all these bricks 6 at a time. And I am going to make some more yet." I told the story of George Black on television. The day after, I found myself talking about him again. An official with the United States Agency for International Development was interested. "I hear you had a story about a brickmaker last night," the official Harvey Witherell said. "Yep," I answered. "Oh, gosh," he said, "I have been looking all over this country for a brickmaker who still does the job by hand. I did not think there were any left. You see, the government of Guyana has a plan to rebuild the country. It does not want a big brick factory. It wants somebody to go from village to village to teach the people how to make bricks for themselves." "Well," I said, "I know the right man for the job. But remember that he is 92 years old. "I do not care how old he is," Harvey Witherell said. "He must be the last person in America to make bricks by hand. Give me his address and telephone number. Mr. Kuralt, you have made my day." I called Mr. Black to warn him what was going to happen. He said he had already received a call from Washington. "Where is Guyana?" he asked. "It is in South America," I said. "My, my," he said. The very next day, Harvey Witherell flew from Washington to Winston-Salem. He and Mr. Black liked each other immediately and quickly reached an agreement. Mr. Black would go to Guyana for 10 days. He would take his granddaughter. She also knew how to make bricks. A young boy would go to help them. Mr. Black would be paid $100 a day. Harvey Witherell said, "This is a wonderful thing you are going to do, Mr. Black. We, in Washington, thank you very much." Mr. Black said simply, "I believe you have chosen the best man to do the job for the USA. Harvey Witherell knew what had to be done. He prepared a detailed proposal. He developed a plan and an emergency plan. He organized every hour of Mr. Black's trip, every visit to every village, every meal. He completed all the necessary documents. He was unbelievably excited. His big project was moving along smoothly. Mr. Black was excited, too. He had never been far from home. Now, he was about to travel to a foreign land as an official representative of the United States of America. I was excited myself. I had visited Guyana as a reporter a number of times in the past. I would now be going back again to report on Mr. Black's trip. As I waited to hear when we would leave, disaster struck. A high official with the Agency for International Development read the proposal. Something, he decided, was not acceptable. He canceled everything. Harvey Witherell called me almost in tears. They say Mr. Black is too old. It did not seem fair for Harvey's big idea to die this way. I did my best to make him feel better. Too bad, I said. Yeah, too bad, he said. It was over. That is, it would have been over. Right then, however, we learned how one part of the government does not always know what another part is doing. Mr. Black, naturally, had told a lot of people about his trip. Someone at a newspaper in Winston-Salem heard about it and said, "That is a good story." And the story appeared on page one of the paper. Next, someone at a national news service read the Winston-Salem paper and said, "That is a good story." And they sent it to newspapers all over the country. Then, someone at the White House read about it and said, "That is a good story." It would be wonderful if the president could see Mr. Black before he goes to Guyana. So on exactly the same day that a government official was canceling Mr. Black's trip, a White House official was inviting him to come to Washington to meet the president. The project became of top importance. All the wheels of government that hours before had rolled backward to a halt now started rolling forward again. So, George Black got to meet the president. He got to go to Guyana, too. There, he taught brickmaking with such energy that everyone around him was tired. One of them was probably the government official who said he was too old for the trip. I have not collected many objects from all the years I was on the road as a reporter. But from the story of George Black, I have two. The first is one of his bricks. It is solid and strong, like the man who made it. The second is a photograph of President Nixon in the Oval Office, surrounded by Mr. Black and his family. In a corner of this photograph is the small face of a man wearing an expression of victory that day. It is the face of Harvey Witherell.
You have just heard the story, Mr. Black, by Charles Kuralt. It is from his book, A Life on the Road, published in 1990, by G.P. Putnam Sons. The story is copyrighted. All rights reserved. It was adapted for Special English by Christine Johnson. Our narrator was Shep O'Neill. This is Shirley Griffith.